Ban surface, and if they are lucky to milk fame and fortune for a few years, they then disappear. Occasionally, solo artists rise out of the ashes of these dead bands to claim second bite of the apple. But there are only a handful who have reinvented themselves to return again and again, and even fewer who have earned the continued respect of fans and peers alike for 3.5 decades. I'm radio journalist Max Susanovich, and throughout this audio documentary we shall attempt to examine how Eric Clapton has become one of the all-time guitar legends. Eric Clapton was born on 30th of March 1945 in Ripley, in the county of Surrey, England. Brought up by his grandparents after his unmarried mother was sent abroad, it was his grandmother who bought the boy that was to become the god of the guitar, his first acoustic guitar, a Hoyer. Learning by ear, Clapton's early influences came from the blues, with heroes like Elvis Presley and singer-songwriter Robert Johnson. And by 16, he was to be found playing acoustic gigs at local pubs and clubs. Influenced further by Muddy Waters and Bo Diddley, Clapton moved on to electric guitar, and with a double cutaway K, once again provided by his grandmother, he formed a duo with Dave Brock, and the two began playing coffee bars from Surrey to South London.
I, as a blues aficionado, many years ago, had to sift through a lot of stuff that I didn't particularly... I mean, there were a lot of blues piano players, a lot of blues harmonica players, a lot of blues guitar players, a lot of blues singers that didn't have a very profound effect on me. I mean, there were a lot of them around, you know, from the 20s onwards that you could say were great, but didn't necessarily grab you by the guts, you know. And then there were others that did, and I don't know to this day why they would have something for me, but I ended up liking, you know, a dozen or so great players and literally robbing them, you know, stealing the bits that I like from their playing and piecing it all together like a sort of kind of hybrid jigsaw puzzle. I think I allowed myself to get into freeform situations, but they weren't very satisfying. I found that I really was still playing what I considered to be the blues, and maybe just now and then edging off into country rock or something, or rock, but never really grasping the jazz theory at all. And I don't really understand jazz theory, and it's, I think, beyond me at this point, and probably always will be. I love it, you know, I love to listen to it, but it leaves me well behind. I remember going back as far as I can, being totally enthralled by some things that I heard on the radio, and other things just left me cold. And the things that really had an effect on me were blues records that would get, for some reason, would just come unannounced. You know, you just hear something on the radio as a child and think, what is that? It was so exotic and spellbinding. Then I had to find out more. I mean, it stirred my curiosity, and I became like a pilgrim, you know.
Music quickly became the focus of his life. A brief period studying at Kingston Art School resulted in expulsion through lack of commitment, but the Kingston School was to have an unlikely influence on his musical career. Introduced to Tom McGinnis by another student, Clapton auditioned for McGinnis's band in the January of 1963 at the Prince of Wales pub New Malden in Surrey, and together with Terry Brennan on vocals, Ben Palmer on piano, and Robin Mason on drums, the Roosters were formed. Gigs, however, were few and far between, and with little money, the band only lasted 7 months. Together with McGinnis, Clapton then joined Casey Jones and the Engineers. The band and Clapton were a poor match, with Brian Casey's penchant for pop music and matching uniforms. It was not long before Clapton went in search of pastures new, and it was at Kingston Art School which provided yet another link to his musical career. The Yardbirds were a Kingston-based band, which formed in August of 1963. Kevin Relf on vocals and harmonica, Anthony Topham on lead guitar, Paul Samuel Smith on bass, Chris Drazier on rhythm guitar, and Jim McCarthy on drums. But by October, Topham had left to continue his education, and Relf remembered the young guitarist from Kingston Art School. Clapton was on his way to becoming a legend. Now living in Kew, South London, with Relf and Drazier, Clapton and his band began gigging around London and Surrey. It didn't take long for their potential to be spotted, and soon after promoter and manager Giorgio Gomelski signed the Yardbirds, Clapton then began to buy the guitars for which he became famous. A Gibson ES-335, two Fenders, the Jazzmaster and the Telecaster. The popularity of the Yardbirds grew, and with it came better gigs, until finally, in 1964, they signed their first record deal with EMI. Almost immediately, they recorded their first ever single, I Wish You Would, followed by their first album, Five Live Yardbirds, recorded at London's famous Marquee Club and released in February 1965. The British music press loved them. They did television shows, toured nationally, even played at the Beatles' Christmas shows, but yet again Clapton was uncomfortable with the musical direction of the band, and in March 1965 he left the Yardbirds. Three bands in 2 years. A pattern of unrest was beginning to appear. Throughout this audio documentary we'll hear from Eric Clapton, historian and web author, Brian Davis.
The Yardbirds started out as a fairly hardcore blues band. They performed with Sonny Boy Williamson and did a lot of covers by people like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. But it didn't take very long for them to start to drift away from that. Their third single was For Your Love, which has pop chords and California-style vocal harmonies. Clapton suggested for that single had been an Otis Redding cover, so you can see that there was something of a difference of opinion, and he left very shortly after that single came out.
Within weeks, Clapton found a new band with whom he felt he could identify, and he joined John Mayall's Bluesbreakers that April. With a new band and a new Gibson Les Paul guitar, Clapton honed his skills. For the first time in months, he was happy. He had musical input in a band who played his kind of music. His reputation grew as the god of guitar, and it was during this time that Mayall actually recorded Primal Solos, which would later be released at the end of the 1970s. So aware of Clapton's talents was Mayall that he even allowed the guitarist to go AWOL when he began exhibiting his usual signs of unrest. This time, though, it was just to have some fun playing with friends in Australia and Greece. Clapton returned to the band to find a new bass player had arrived in the shape of Jack Bruce, and the two of them quickly became firm friends. But within months, Bruce had left to join Manfred Mann, causing Clapton to feel unsettled once more. Mayall paid tribute to the guitarist's talent by naming him on the band's album, The Bluesbreakers with Eric Clapton, but that was still not enough to hold the ever-agitated musician, and when drummer Ginger Baker started talking to Clapton about forming a new group, he gave Mayall 2 weeks' notice and left. With the proviso that Bruce joined the band as a bass player, May 1966 saw the birth of Clapton's next vehicle. Cream had been formed. Let's hear from Willie Morgan, who, as publicity director in the 70s at RCA Records, was in an excellent position to view Clapton's burgeoning talents.
What can one say about Eric Clapton that hasn't been said or written hundreds of times before? Everybody knows he was born in 45 in Ripley. And he came out of art school to join a band called the Roosters with Tom McGuinness. Tom is somebody I know very well, played for many years with Manfred Mann and the Lyle McGuinness band, and then the blues band. Anyway, Eric's just been one of these people who's grown up to have a reputation as being one of Britain's most finest guitarists, and one of the world's finest guitarists. He got into a band called the Yardbirds. In fact, he joined them in 1963, replaced a guy called Tony Topham, and got the nickname Slow Hands. It's one of many nicknames that Eric's had. Actually, not many. Either Slow Hand or God, really. Earlier, of course, as I say, he played in the Yardbirds, but was very, very much into the blues side of things. And he actually got cheesed off with the Yardbirds when they started to go a bit commercial. He played on their first two singles, I Wish You Would and Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. And they even recorded a live album with Sonny Boy Williamson, but it was about March 65 he had enough, because the Yardbirds recorded For Your Love, which turned out to be a big pop hit, and he didn't want to have anything part of that, so he was out, and some new guitarist by the name of Jeff Beck replaced him. But Clapton went on to play with John Mayall's Bluesbreakers, and that's even if people haven't got the album, will always remember the album cover, for the simple reason that at the front of it, Eric Clapton sat there reading the Beano, which was a boys' comic magazine every kid used to get the Beano every week. And even though Eric, on the cover of that album, seemed to be a little bit too old for the Beano, the fact is that none of us are ever too old for the Beano. One or two books actually refer to the album that Eric Clapton cut with John Mayall's Bluesbreakers. As the Beano album, and it's still considered to this very day the classic British blues album. In fact, prior to that album being recorded, Eric went off and, as I say, joined the Blues Breakers, but actually at one point disappeared, and it turned out 6 weeks later in Greece he just went off to stay with some friends. But he rejoined Mail and stayed with Mail from 66 until the until July 66, time he formed the band Cream.
The psychedelic sound of Cream brought them a large following on the college circuit, and it was at the Polytechnic of Central London that Clapton jammed with Jimi Hendrix, a man who was to have a great influence on his playing. At around the same time, Cream's first single, Wrapped Paper, was released along with the album Fresh Cream. They played on BBC Radio and Britain's fashionable TV music show, Ready Steady Go. The band were becoming the supergroup of the moment. Their second single, I Feel Free, was an anthem for the hippie culture around them. And with their next single, Strange Brew, came rumours of magic mushrooms and drug abuse. By now it was mid-1967. The band's popularity in Britain was unquestionable, but the American market still lay wide open. After recording Disraeli Gears, their second album, in New York, with Felix Pappalardi producing and Tom Dowd engineering, the Cream returned that August to gig at Bill Graham's Fillmore West in San Francisco. After the release of Disraeli Gears in the November, the band continued to tour heavily, but as their popularity soared, so did the friction within the band. Bruce and Baker never had liked each other, and now their fighting was becoming almost unbearable. 1968 saw their longest ever tour of America, 3.5 months with only one short break. But the contention within the band was still growing, and with it, reports of super egos. Some of their most classic work was still to be heard, however. Sunshine of Your Love, White Room, and the album Wheels of Fire. But it was clear that the band would not, could not, last. They began a spate of goodbye tours, and even their final album, released in March the following year, held the same name. But sadly, the end of 1968 saw the end of Cream. Let's hear once again from historian Brian Davis.
Cream was a trio, with Jack Bruce on bass, Ginger Baker on drums, and Eric, of course, on guitar. These were three very, very strong personalities, so it wasn't too surprising that they broke up after not too long. They did stay together for about 2.5 years and put out 4 albums, and a lot of the songs from those albums, White Room, Sunshine of Your Love, Crossroads, are still staples of FM radio to this day.
Now let's hear once again from former RCA publicity director Willie Morgan, and then Eric himself.
I was talking recently with an old friend of mine by the name of Muff Winwood, who's the brother of Steve Winwood. I said to him, well, we've known each other from the early days, but tell me about even the earlier than the early days. And he was telling me about the days that Spencer Davis Group came down from Birmingham and started to tour the UK. And he said that one guy always turned up at their London gigs, particularly their North London gigs, and one that he was very reminded of was an area in North London called Manor House, which to any Londoner will know is situated somewhere between the Arsenal and Tottenham Hotspur football ground. But one particular gig that stuck in my memory was the fact that Eric always used to turn up at Spencer Davis Group gigs and bring his guitar with and see if he could come and join them on stage, and he invariably did. And to think that here's this young aspiring guitarist with a band that were already starting to have some success, and then you start to think these things through and think, ah, now there's the connection which led Eric Clapton, when he left Cream, to nab hold of Steve Winwood when he left the Spencer Davis Group to form the group Blind Faith. And there's the connection. There they were, the demise of Cream, when Ginger Baker and Eric Clapton left poor old Jack Bruce in the lurch, grabbing Rick Gretsch out of family as well, and that's how Blind Faith performed. And the very first ever supergroup. Unfortunately, it was relatively short-lived. It wasn't very successful, but they left behind one excellent album, and one that's very, very enjoyable. And I think that some of Eric's playing on the Blind Faith album is amongst the best of his works.
There's no doubt about it. Cream had definitely had an aim and a direction to go in, but we lost it, and we lost the direction through just touring without stopping and re-evaluating where we were going. You know, we got to a point during sort of six-month tours where we were just, you know, doing it by numbers and going over the same old ground, and seeing that we could make a lot of money that way without really having to stretch or to reassess the situation, and the music got very old and a little bit childish and a little bit careless. And when I heard Big Pink, it sounded like there was someone, there was definitely another place to go, or maybe there was a lesson to be learned from hearing that album, you know, that it was time to look at what we had and decide whether or not we should go on or to find another place to be. I think I would have at some point earlier in Cream, if I'd had more power of personality and more authority, I would have insisted that we had a keyboard player, and I would have chosen Steve Winwood. I mean, it kept being a fantasy of mine that Steve would join Cream, but I never pushed the point. You know, I just didn't feel confident enough to broach the subject. And maybe I did a couple of times, but I think it was discounted, because there was so much volatile emotion in that band. It was very unstable and very difficult to say, look, calm down, let's talk this out. Because I mean, it was a time of drugs too. You know, we were all taking a lot of dope and drinking and everything. So to get the three guys, and I include myself in this, to sit down and talk about the musical value of the band and what we could do to make it better and what we should, which direction we should go, this was out of the question. You know, we were just having a lot of fun as well. You know, I was smoking a lot of grass, I think, and we did a lot of acid too. Yeah.
6 months later, Clapton joined with ex-Traffic star Steve Winwood to form Blind Faith. Somewhat surprisingly, Winwood then invited Ginger Baker to play drums, as well as Rick Grace. Blind Faith then played their first gig on the 7th of June 1969 in London's Hyde Park. In the eyes of many critics, the new band seemed to have little musical direction. They released one album, Blind Faith, in August 1969, notable for the track Presence of the Lord, for which Clapton had written both the music and the lyrics. They toured America, and then Clapton's enthusiasm for the band once again simply fizzled out. He set off for Los Angeles to record with Delaney and Bonnie, who had, in fact, acted as Blind Faith's support on that tour.
Clapton's next band after leaving Cream was called Blind Faith, and that was a band that had a lot of baggage on it in the very beginning. One of Eric's big reasons for leaving Cream had been to get away from the bickering with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce, and Ginger Baker wound up being the drummer for Blind Faith, so that was one strike against it right there. The big problem, though, was that all of the members of the band, Steve Winwood, Eric Clapton, Rick Grech, and Ginger Baker, had achieved a certain amount of stardom from their previous efforts, and so expectations were very high on the band at the outset, and they really weren't given the time to build up the chemistry, to build up a good body of songs, to live up to those expectations. And so the band ended up collapsing after one album and about 8 months.
There was a period between the breakup of Cream and the actual working of Blind Faith that was very satisfactory for me, when I was getting to know Steve Winwood and getting to know how to play with him, and we did a lot of jamming at one another's houses, and also in the studio, just playing other people's songs. You know, that's how, for instance, the Buddy Holly song, Well Alright, came to be. We were playing, you know, we'd play the songbook and just have fun, and that was a great time. It was the disillusionment came with the concept of the supergroup that it was labelled with, and the immediate hype that was thrust upon us, where, you know, we were doing a world tour much too soon and trying to live up to a musical background that we hadn't established. I was so happy to be accompanying Steve Winwood, to play alongside him and not have to think about being a front man, you know. But he wanted me to sing too. I mean, he was very frustrated with Blind Faith, because he didn't just want to be the front man. He wanted to form a band. We all wanted to form a band, and I wasn't really contributing enough. And with Delaney and Bonnie, I saw another way out, you know. I saw a way out where I could be a sideman. And on top of that, they were genuine R&B singers and players from the South. And I've never played with people like that before. I've never played with the real thing. I mean, it'd always been with, first of all, John Mayall, you know, an English blues band. Then with Cream, a kind of blues rock fusion band. Then with Blind Faith, more of a rock and roll band. And here was a genuine American R&B band that, you know, could play anything from Larry Williams to Sam and Dave to Robert Johnson, all the way through the Black Songbook. And it was what I'd really been waiting for all my life, to get into that situation, and I had a great time.
But 1969 was also to throw up another historical association with John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. Clapton played in several of their tracks and made two appearances with the Plastic Ono Band. The first, a concert in Toronto, reported to have actually been rehearsed on board the plane going to Canada, and the second, on the 15th of December, at a Peace for Christmas concert, along with Delaney and Bonnie, with whom he had been touring in Europe since November. Let's hear again from Willie Morgan.
As I said, Eric's addiction to heroin has been well documented, and perversely, I thought it was quite amusing that Eric was persuaded by John Lennon to join the Plastic Ono Band at that famous concert that was recorded, that was performed and indeed recorded for an album at the Toronto Rock and Roll Revival, and also performed in London, the Lyceum. And the track that Eric played on was Cold Turkey, which probably, well, you have to laugh really, and I'm sure these years later you can laugh.
Clapton seemed happy with Delaney and Bonnie and friends. Taking a back seat, he directed his concentration on recording a solo album, not released until August 1970. The tour moved on to the US, but by March 1970, Clapton felt it was time to leave them. Delaney and Bonnie were rumoured to be unmoved. The irony of Eric Clapton's next band, Derek and the Dominoes, was that it was made up of ex-members of Delaney and Bonnie. Carl Raddle, Jim Gordon, and Bobby Whitlock had been fired. But this was the band that was to record some of Clapton's greatest ever anthems. Derek and the Dominoes' first single was Tell the Truth in September 1970, with guest appearances by Dave Mason and George Harrison. The band, however, hated it. Produced by Phil Spector on loan from Harrison in return for their earlier work on All Things Must Pass, they felt it had been overproduced, and the single was withdrawn the same week as its issue.
I think what happened really was that Delaney fired his band, and I was contacted by Carl, I think, or Jim Gordon, and said that, you know, they'd been fired. Did I want a band? And I said, oh, all right. Not really knowing what I was getting into, you know, because sometimes I say yes to things when I don't really know whether it's a good idea or not. And next thing I knew, I had these four American guys living in my house with me, playing music non-stop, and it was great. We wanted to be a band, and I didn't really want to, once again, be the, you know, I didn't feel that I'd earned enough respect in the public eye to be the singer, you know, Eric Clapton and his band. It would have spoiled it for me if I'd had to go out and lead it. Whereas I could lead it from the inside in a subtle way if it was called something else. And these guys were steeped in the blues and steeped in R&B. And if you just let them jam, you know, they'd be playing exactly what you want to hear. So that was one of my favourite bands of all time.
The first album, however, was a different story. Recorded in Florida and produced by Duane Allman, Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs was to provide Clapton with one of his most memorable songs. It is written in the annals of history that Layla referred to George Harrison's then-wife, Patti Boyd. Clapton's unrequited love for Boyd not only produced one of his most emotive songs, it also drew him further and further into the depths of heroin addiction. In the wake of the ever-traditional sex, drugs and rock and roll, Derek and the Dominoes split before they could even finish their second album.
A few months after recording the album with Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett and their backing band, the group began to splinter. And Eric was able to hire away three of the alumni, Bobby Whitlock, the piano player, Jim Gordon, the drummer, and Carl Radle, the bassist, to form his new band, the enigmatically titled Derek and the Dominoes. This was during a very troubled period in Clapton's personal life. He was getting in serious trouble with heroin addiction, and had also managed to fall deeply in love with George Harrison's wife. And between this personal trauma, his growing talents not just as a guitarist, but more specifically as a singer and as a songwriter, and the quality of the musicians behind him, they were able to produce one absolutely fantastic album, Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs, which is my favorite album of all time.
Over the years, Eric Clapton has collected more and more friends. He seems to have friends in so many different spheres, from John Mayall to his as I say, his association with the Winwood brothers, and of course one can't overlook his eventual association with the Beatles. Now, how did he get friendly with the Beatles? Well, in fact, one of the very first bands he ever joined was a band called Casey Jones and the Engineers. He played with just about six or seven gigs around about 1963. And the group was led by a guy called Brian Casser, who called himself Casey Jones. And he had fronted one of the top bands in Liverpool, Cass and the Casanovas. Well, whilst Eric was in the Yardbirds, he actually appeared on the Beatles' Christmas show at the Hammersmith Odeon. The thing was, he developed a particular friendship with fellow guitarist George Harrison, and that lasted for quite a long time. In fact, whilst when Eric had come to the point where he decided that Cream were to be disbanded, they recorded an album called Goodbye Cream, the final album. On that song, on that album, there was a song called Badge, which a certain guitarist was credited on the sleeve as being one L'Angelo Misterioso, for contractual reasons George Harrison couldn't be credited. But in fact, part of that song was written by two members of the Beatles. George wrote a certain element of the song, but there was one line that went, "They tell me about birds that they sing in the park," I think was the line. That was written by Ringo Starr. Not uncredited, but that is fact. By this time, George and Eric had become very, very friendly, and George at the time was recording for the Apple label a guy called Jackie Lomax, and Eric came in and played on that. Then an absolute precedent was set. Eric performed on a Beatles track. George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which finally saw the light of day on the double album, The Beatles, commonly known as the White Album, with so many Beatles fans saying George is a better guitarist than Eric, and you know, the usual rivalry, you're either a Stones fan or a Beatles fan, you're either a George Harrison fan or an Eric Clapton fan. To many Beatles fans, it was almost sacrilege that Eric Clapton was playing on a Beatles track, but hey, George and Eric were mates, and that was that. The bizarre thing that came out of this friendship was that George Harrison was married to Patty Boyd, the wonderfully beautiful actress who had a very small part in the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night, and Patty Boyd became Patty Harrison. Well, one can't be absolutely certain whether the marriage went on for the rocks or she was swept off her feet by Eric, but before you knew it, she was Patty Clapton, as it were. And Eric and Patty had gone off. George was left without a wife. Yet, bizarrely, it didn't sour the relationship between George Harrison and Eric Clapton.
That was in April 1971, but instead of bouncing straight into another new band, Clapton sunk even deeper into the world of his drug addiction. In the August, he surfaced long enough to fly to New York for George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh in Madison Square Gardens, but the stories tell us of a jet-lagged Clapton arriving desperate for a fix, and unable to play until at least the heroin substitutes, methadone Linctus, could be provided. It was another 2 years before Clapton made his next appearance. Still addicted to smack, he joined Pete Townsend, Ronnie Wood, Jim Capaldi and Steve Winwood for a concert at the Rainbow Theatre in London. That was January 1973. Then he disappeared from sight once more. On the 10th of April 1974, a now heroin-free Clapton emerged to give a press conference. His cure had been radical electric treatment, and he was ready to record the new band, aptly named Eric Clapton and His Band, which consisted of ex-Derek and the Dominoes bass player, Carl Rydell, George Terry on guitar, Derek Sims on keyboard, Jamie Oldacre on drums, and the vocals of Yvonne Elliman.
Clapton's heroin addiction turned him into a hermit for about 3 years, from 1971 to 1974, and it was only the help of friends like Pete Townsend and experimental treatments like acupuncture that were able to nurse him back to health and eventually get him back on stage. His comeback performance was at the Rainbow Theater and was recorded and eventually released as an album.
Musically, this was the start of a completely new era for Clapton. Gone were the guitar solos that had made him an idol. Gone was the need to keep searching for past as new. With his own band, Clapton seemed to have found what he was looking for. Eric Clapton and His Band hit number one in the States with their very first single, the Bob Marley classic, I Shot the Sheriff. Oddly, Clapton's first ever number one there. It was August 1974, and with the release of 461 Ocean Boulevard, the band started touring America, but Clapton could not take the pressure. He had given up heroin, now he turned to alcohol, and his drunken behavior was, to say the least, erratic both on stage and off, and even included a famous streaking incident on board a passenger plane. Clapton's next album, There's One in Every Crowd, was produced by his long-term associate Tom Dowd, and contained several songs by the brilliant Marcy Levy, better known nowadays as Marcella Detroit. Joining them at the studios in Jamaica as a vocalist, it was she who later co-wrote Lay Down Sally. The touring continued, Japan, Europe, and now an item with Patty Boyd, who had split from George Harrison. The press were almost more interested in their relationship than his music. But his London concerts were met with acclaim, and his drinking had become more controlled. Thanks to the British tax system, however, April 1975 saw Clapton leave England to set up home with Patty on Paradise Island in the Bahamas. Staying away for the next couple of years, he toured the Southern Hemisphere, Australia and New Zealand, and then went back to America for yet even more touring. The American tour coincided with the release of Bob Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door, and the album EC was here. It was August 1975. Another tour of Japan followed, but it is amazing how Clapton always found time to jam with his peers, joining the Rolling Stones at Madison Square and Bob Dylan in the recording studio, the result of which was Romance and Durango. A year later, the release of the album No Reason to Cry was a testament to his interaction with other musicians, not just people like Bob Dylan and Marcy Levy, but Billy Preston, Ronnie Wood and Van Morrison. The album made the UK top 10 and the US top 20. 18 months passed, and a new, more seductive mood had taken over Clapton. His influences had become more country, and under the guidance of producer Glyn Johns, Slow Hand was recorded. There were reports of tension between artist and producer, but the resulting album reached number 2 in the States, and on the back of its success, Clapton began touring again, this time, though, without Element.
Round about the late 70s, when country music was getting very popular pop-wise, and we were seeing pop crossover hits and artists like Harry Wynette and Crystal Gayle were coming over and setting up concerts. One fellow who came over and was extremely popular in Britain was a strange-looking fellow called Don Williams. Don had been in a group called the Pogo Seeker Singers. Eric was very attracted to Don's stage persona and his playing and his style. And his, I mean, laid back isn't the way to describe John Williams on stage. He was so laid back, he was almost comatose. But Eric was a big fan, and I remember seeing going to one of Don's concerts. At the time I was dating the secretary of the promoter. And as a consequence, we were invited to the after-show party. And unfortunately, at this time, Eric was suffering his problems with either drink or drugs or both. Well documented, so we're not beating around any bushes here. Eric's been quite open about the problems he's had over the years. And at the party, I don't know where Eric had been, but he came in well juiced. And it was a bit of a shame, really, because one tried to have a conversation with him and say, hey, man, I've always liked what you've done, and this kind of thing and that kind of thing. And he wasn't really up for it. In fact, somebody annoyed him. Wasn't me. Somebody annoyed him. And he got quite abusive to this person and wanted to find Patty to go, and she was in another part of the room talking to someone else, and it was a bit of a shame, but it gave an insight to me for the kind of pressure that an artist like him can face. Here's someone who's terribly artistic, and sometimes people at these kind of functions can get up someone's nose. It can really be aggravating. And the point is that any artistic person, you have to take on board where they're coming from, and you have to be sympathetic to the problems they're encountering. I don't mean the problems of drink and drugs, but just the day-to-day pressures that one feels. You can't always be on top form all the time.
1979 saw Clapton collaborate with Johns once more for the album Backless. Again, there were reports of friction between the two, on top of which George Terry had left the band, although he did contribute to the album. And he also lost his second female vocalist and, more importantly, co-writer, Marcy Levy. With only Raddle, Timms and Old Acre remaining, the four began a European tour to complement the album's November release. The tour was a tremendous success, and Eric fulfilled a lifelong ambition by being supported by the great Muddy Waters. It clearly had a huge impact on him.
With Muddy, I was always in awe. You know, it was just completely, like, subservient to him. I just thought that he was, you know, God, really. And I think it would have been the same if it had been with Robert Johnson. These were people from a different era, don't forget, though. You know, they were heroes that had their prime almost before I was born. And so they were untouchable, you know, completely untouchable. I mean, I could sit and play with Muddy, but it wouldn't, I'd still, there'd be this huge distance. Because, you know, as great as Muddy was, I knew him in his declining years, and I kind of missed his prime. I mean, I'd love to have been around Chicago when he was like in his mid-20s. That would have been something else. He was passing on as much wisdom as he could, I mean, which is quite an act of faith for someone like that, because he didn't really know that much about me. He knew I cared about the music, but he spent a lot of time trying, sometimes without success, to endow or instill into me a sense of value for the music, you know. Because I think at that time he may have sensed that I was going through a little bit of an identity problem, not knowing whether I should go into a J.J. Cale kind of thing, or, you know, be laid back, or more aggressive, or I just didn't know what I was doing very well. And being around Muddy was very inspiring. I mean, he came to my aid, you know, he really did. He sensed that there was something not quite right, and he just kept telling me, well, you know, you're a blues guitar player, just keep playing that. I would say sometimes, you know, this feels really strange to have you out there, and then me go on, it's very difficult for me. And he would just say, you know, that I wouldn't have it any other way. And he would say it was an honour for him. So what are you going to do, you know?
The strain on Clapton to perform as lead guitarist and vocalist was obvious to even the most naive observer, and he eventually brought in Albert Lee. After a short Irish tour and 3 weeks in Japan to break in the newly recruited guitarist, Clapton returned to tour America, where he finally married Boyd, and in true rock and roll style, three of the Beatles played at the reception held later at the end of the year back in England. The US tour ended on the 29th of June, 1979, and sure enough, Clapton fired Raddle, Sims and Oldacre. Yet again, Clapton was in search of something new. Keeping Lee on guitar, new, meant returning to his British roots. Chris Stainton and Gary Brooker, ex of Procol Harum, were brought in to play keyboards. Dave Marquis played bass, Henry Sinetti was on drums, and new also meant his first world tour playing exceptional places like Thailand and Poland. New then meant a new live album, Just One Night, recorded in December 1979 in Tokyo. New, however, did not mean giving up drinking. Having recorded another ticket, Clapton and his band set off to promote the newly released album, but alcoholism took its toll, and in March 1981, Clapton was rushed, in agony, from the stage at Madison, Wisconsin, to St. Paul's United Hospital. He had 5 ulcers, one so large, in fact, that it was about to burst his pancreas. 1981 was not to be his happiest year. A car accident followed. He had also developed pleurisy, and his marriage to Boyd was collapsing. Clapton was forced to rethink his lifestyle. If 1981 had been a miserable year for Eric Clapton, then 1982 and 83 saw a great improvement. A somewhat cleaned up, somewhat reformed man, Clapton left the Robert Stigwood organization, the management company that had supported him since the early 1970s, replaced all the band members, bar Lee, and started Duck Records, his own recording label. The result was the much criticized album Money and Cigarettes, released in February 1983. Produced by Tom Down and featuring Donald Duck Dunn on bass, Ry Cooder on guitar and Robert Hawkins on drums, it was not the music that had caused the stir, but the sponsorship given by Camel Cigarettes. With the reintroduction of Stainton on keyboards and Oldacre on drums, the band set off to promote the album and celebrate Clapton's 20 years in the business. The pinnacle of the tour had to be the remarkable performance with some of rock's greatest legends at the Royal Albert Hall in London. The concert, dedicated to action research into multiple sclerosis, in aid of the Small Faces bassist Ronnie Lane, brought together such names as Charlie Watts, Bill Wyman, Kenny Jones, Steve Winwood, and Andy Fairweather Lowe. But the highlight was unarguably Clapton, Jimmy Page, and Jeff Beck, all playing Layla together. It was the ultimate supergroup, and Clapton even persuaded several of them to do a short tour with him in America.
It was a completely different kettle of fish for me, because I play I play with as little rehearsal as possible. I mean, I try to make the whole thing come alive on stage, and the Dire Straits experience is a little different from that, because Mark, when we did, when we rehearsed for the Mandela thing, we rehearsed for almost 2 weeks, I think, three shows a day, to get it nailed completely down so that there are literally no mistakes. And that was very unusual for me to do that. I found it quite hard, but very rewarding. And that led to, well, in fact, that came after a series of concerts where he had played with me as my co-guitarist, and then he asked, because Jack Sonny wasn't available to do the Mandela thing, I stepped in and helped Dire Straits on the Mandela show. And now, it looks like at Nebworth, I'm playing host to Mark, because I think he wants to do some Dire Straits material. And he's not really, I don't know how it stands, but maybe he hasn't got the time to rehearse the band. So, or maybe we just wanted to do it with me, but we're going to have Mark Knopfler and his bass player come on and do, yeah, with my band, and do some Dire Straits material. Also, I understand, I'm never completely certain about these things. I hear it, all takes place through management, you know, a lot of the time. I hear that I think Elton will be on. So it'll be a band with me, that is, and that it'll be like the band we took to Japan a couple of years ago. We don't really need to rehearse much. I mean, we've all played together so many times now. I think one day, I mean, if we get together for one day and just go over the stuff, we'll get it, you know.
Phil Collins wants to produce his next album, Behind the Sun. The album showed off Clapton's guitar talent to a whole new generation, and his exposure at the 1985 Live Aid concert boosted his status as super guitarist even further, when he commenced his set with White Room and culminated it some 20 and exhilarating minutes later with Layla. Let's hear for a final time from Eric Clapton historian Brian Davis.
The most impressive thing about Clapton's solo career, to me, has been the breadth of styles that it has covered. In addition to the classic rock numbers that you hear so often, Clapton also has shown an interest in reggae. In the mid-70s, he recorded an album in Jamaica with Peter Tosh. That was the period that spawned the number one single, I Shot the Sheriff. In the 80s, Clapton moved in a much more pop direction and recorded with Phil Collins and others. And then in the 90s, Clapton made an annual ritual of going to the Royal Albert Hall for a series of concerts, which included blues bands and renditions of his old hits backed with a complete orchestra.
Clapton fan and drummer with respected London-based band Invisible, Steve Byrne was lucky enough to catch a couple of Eric's shows at the magnificent Albert Hall.
When I first saw Eric Clapton, it was in the early 90s when he was playing his yearly concerts around the January and February time. It's 1991. And what's most amazing about the concert was actually the different generations of fans. There were 14-year-olds to 44-year-olds, young mods to Asian hippies. Of course, the Albert Hall was a regal setting for the King of Blues. With his band that night was Phil Collins on drums and Mark Knopfler on guitar. Both those stars are worth £20 themselves, but for them to join in with Eric Clapton was obviously definitely a bonus. He played all these hits, starting off with The White Room, ending up with one of the latest songs of his new album at that time, August. The atmosphere was fantastic, especially for someone who'd been around such a long time. I went again some couple of years later. At this particular concert, he started off with an acoustic set. And again, even though there was no stars at this one, the set was pretty much the same, but enjoyment was just as much satisfactory as the first time. What he did try out, actually, one year was very interesting, was he had three different sets. He had the first week, Eric Clapton and his band. The second week was Eric Clapton and his blues band, and on the third week was Eric Clapton and the London Symphony Orchestra. Again, the orchestra would have been fantastic to see, but I opted for the band, and it was just his normal band at the time, which included Nathan East, which I think is one of the world's greatest bass players, but of course, with one of the world's greatest guitarists, you definitely need one of the world's greatest bass players, as for Steve Ferrone, formerly of the Average White Band, on drums. What he tends to do actually is play all the hits, then he slows down, brings a couple of chairs up and plays an acoustic set with about two or three of the guitars out of the band, and before ending with Layla and White Room, and Wonderful Tonight, which normally tends to bring the house down.
1986 saw Clapton's sound changed again, and once again he put together a new lineup and brought in Phil Collins to produce his latest album, One More Car, One More Rider. This was the year that also saw a great change in his personal life, and in August 1986, a son, Connor, was born to his latest girlfriend, Laurie DeSanto. The album was renamed August to mark his son's birth, and Boyd and Clapton divorced amid revelations that Clapton already had a 9-year-old daughter, Ruth, by somebody else. And the British press, in true tradition, dedicated plenty of column inches to Eric's offstage activities.
I try and conduct a fairly private life, but it's difficult, you know, especially, for instance, in England, because it's such a close-knit community that anything that happens to anybody is news. I think it's not so bad in America. And not so bad in Europe either, that, you know, you can do a lot of things quite publicly and it won't cause so much of a stir. But England is, it's like I'm being under a microscope. And it depends what they think of you. If they're out to get you, they will do their best to get you, you know. And there's no knowing why they will do that. It's just your flavour of the month, you know, to be hunted down.
The next 5 years were to bring a whirlwind of high-profile tours and sessions with a never-ending list of celebrity artists. Even his album, such as Journeyman, released in November 1989, boasted some great names, such as Chaka Khan, Daryl Hall, and again his old pal George Harrison. Clapton recorded film and soundtracks, was honoured with awards and television tribute programs, but personal tragedy was about to strike yet again. In the spring of 1991, his son Connor was tragically killed when he fell from the window of his ex-girlfriend's Manhattan high-rise apartment. Devastated, Clapton submerged himself within a frenzy of work. You only have to listen for the heart-rending tears in heaven to appreciate the depths of pain that Clapton was fighting. In the twist of fate that is life, his greatest tragedy provided him with an MTV Award for Best Video and the power to make the 90s his greatest ever era. Let's hear for a last time from Willie Morgan.
He suffered, of course, the terrible, terrible misfortune of losing his son Connor. It had a profound effect on him, and by goodness me, what parent wouldn't be devastated by the loss of a child? And the song Tears in Heaven came from it. It was one way of showing his grief. And, you know, that's the way in which an autistic person perhaps can show their grief. Those of us with a lot less talent than Eric Clapton would have to find a different way. And it's good to see that these days Eric has cleaned up his act. The chemicals have left his body. He's, well, I say growing old gracefully, not that he looks old, but he's not frightened to wear his spectacles on stage. Many years ago, pop stars didn't want to be seen wearing them, unless, of course, you were Buddy Holly. And he does his concerts, he performs with guys like Robert Fray, still playing the blues. And the great thing is he does blues concerts and he does regular concerts. So the aficionados who've been with him from the beginning can go and see him play the blues. And those who perhaps have been listening to AOR radio who want to hear more of Wonderful Tonight and stuff like that won't be disappointed either. But he's a showman, he's a technician, he's an artist, he's respected worldwide. I've never actually heard anybody within the industry, be they artist or a journalist or a broadcaster, say anything bad about his work. There may be a bit of a criticism about his behaviour when he's been under the influence, and one would expect that, and he wouldn't want to deny it. But he's a popular guy, Eric. Everybody loves him.
Having locked himself away in Antigua to write the soundtrack to the film Rush, which was to feature Tears in Heaven, Clapton finally emerged from solitude in December of 1991, only to plunge himself into a tour of Japan with George Harrison, still one of his closest pals. January 1992 brought a new spate of touring Europe and America, including some memorable shows at Wembley Stadium with Elton John and a two-hour MTV Unplugged session, which was to sell almost 13 million copies. But for many, 1993 was the year to remember, when on the 13th of January, a quarter of a century after they had split, Cream reformed for a one-off performance at Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards. Perhaps inspired by the reunion, Clapton seemed to return to his musical roots, and in 1994 he released the raw, blues-orientated From the Cradle album. It was as if Clapton had realised what everybody else already knew, that he hadn't needed to keep on changing, that it was the natural talent of that 16-year-old kid playing his acoustic hoya in the local pubs of Surrey that would make him the most respected musician of our time, whatever he played.
When I came to New York last year and I turned on the radio, I hear Cream and I hear the old Eric Clapton stuff, and I think, well, now, you know, surely, that, you know, it's great really that I'm getting this booster from the past. If I had become popular in the early 80s or late 70s, I wouldn't be getting this, you know, I'd be somewhere in the middle in limbo. But the fact that it's getting kind of free promotion, I'm getting this, so there's, you know, it can go two ways. You know, a lot of people get stuck in that thing, get stuck in the past and only want to hear that material, and a lot of other people that have got more open minds that know that that's what you did then and they can't wait to see what you're going to do now.